On Sunday morning, April 28th, 2002, I was able to talk with Hal Crowther, sitting on the porch of the cabin he owns with his wife, the novelist Lee Smith, in the mountains of North Carolina. I'm wondering about what would warm up Mencken's pen and mind these days, about what exercises you about what's going on. It's a troubling time, isn't it? It's confusing, it's alarming.
Yeah, I think our culture's breaking down completely. I think that, you know, that again, this is political and this is radical politics almost. I think that without noticing it, just through the, you know, the sort of the workings of the marketplace, we're living in a society in the United States where corporate will, you know, not concerted corporate will. I'm not saying that they don't get together, as some people on the left believe. You know, they said they go out to a Bohemian Grove, is it, in California, and they all sit around and they figure out their plan for to enslave America for the next 5 years. I don't believe that. It's just the way the marketplace works, that you can make quicker profits by constantly combining, you know, your forces with other people and merger after merger, buyout after buyout. So things get bigger and bigger, more and more remote, not only from the consumer, but from their own employees and from any sort of responsibility from their investors. And it just gets larger and larger, and they have these enormous arms, you know, that produce media, that produce advertising, that subvert academia, not because they have a concerted purpose, but just because they're trying to do business and make the most money that they can, maximize their profit. The maximizing the profit for enormous, gargantuan corporations has totally taken all the juice out of America. I mean, and most Americans don't even see it. I mean, this is what always kind of astonishes me, is that a right-wing radio demagogue can stir up people easily against the federal government, which is basically, you know, usually kind of clunky and run by people who are second rate, and basically is still, to some degree, at our beck and call. I mean, we can throw these people out of office, even though they are totally supported and chosen by corporations. We have some power over them. But if you try to stir up people against corporations, they just go blank. And I think partly because they spend their whole lives in electronic media looking at these presentations, which are basically happy face presentations, you know, of giant corporations, these commercials. You know, this is what people see. This is what they know. It's part of their lifeblood. And they cannot think of those people who put the happy face on the screen as the other or as a threatening other. And this is sort of the hardest message. And that's why my favorite national columnist, you know, sort of daily columnist is Molly Ivins, because she's absolutely, and incidentally, she was in my class at Columbia, along with Geraldo Rivera, the famous trio. But Molly has been on message for 20 years. She's just saying, look, and wherever, you know, you want to find what's going wrong in this country, just follow the money. And you won't go wrong. Follow the money. I mean, that's why basically a lot of these conservative pundits, you know, these George Wills and so on, I mean, basically, if you analyze them at all, I mean, I'm not against them because they're conservative. I have some very conservative attitudes myself. They're just, you know, they're not following their own logical trail. I mean, basically, they're stopping here and making camp and refusing, you know, to read the writing on the wall. And it's kind of pitiful. I mean, and some of these people are celebrated for being wrong time after time after time after time. And I think even in our field, you know, I'm sort of getting away from daily journalism more now, but in that field, I think people should be held accountable. I think if people look back and find out what I said about, you know, the breakup of the Cold War, or what I said about what happened in Central America, what I said about, you know, elections and who would win and who they would appoint and all these things, if I'm always wrong, I think I should be out of work. And I don't understand why in this country where everything is, you know, breaks up into these ideological teams, why people who are never right are not only still working but are celebrated. I mean, that's just a little...
You know, I think both you and I are in an unusual situation with regard to the American public at large, I guess because we're writers. And in my case, I may be even more severely out of step because I'm a poet, and poetry is certainly not something the public is paying much attention. Instead of the written word, people are into the quick media, television, radio. Well, on the other hand, I think that my work and my training in the analysis of text is in part what helps keep me from being completely snowed by the media and the powers that be.
Well, you recognize rhetorical devices, you know, and most people don't.
Are we dinosaurs? Are we on our way out? Are we just marginalized? Or how are you seeing that?
Well, I think in a sense we're probably going to be forced underground. There was a book I read recently. It was published by Norton, and it's a fellow named Berman, and it was something like the not the death, but the something of American culture. And, you know, he just explains that this is not going to turn around anytime soon, but he uses as an example of what might be done, the monks in the Middle Ages, you know, who sort of went into the cloisters and kept copying Aristotle, you know, waiting for the thaw. And, you know, things can change. I can't look in the crystal ball and see how it's going to change. There was a terrible article in the New York Times not long ago. It was about the National Magazine Awards. I can plug myself. I'm a finalist for the National Magazine Award in commentary. And there was an article about those awards, you know, and talking about some of the writers who'd been nominated. But the writer sort of implied that we were indeed all dinosaurs. And then he went and interviewed a bunch of new, young, hot magazine editors. And they were basically saying, well, nobody reads beyond the first six paragraphs. You know, people criticize my magazine because all our articles are eight paragraphs long. Hey, listen, I'm giving you the part that all that anyone ever reads anyway. You know, of course, I'm burning, but I know this is to some degree true. And if I'd be one of the first people to be a dinosaur, I think, because I work by indirection. You know, I use sometimes slightly arcane rhetorical devices. I mean, I'll steer the reader in one direction, you know, trying to amuse him all the time if I can. But I'll take him in one direction and then kind of show him that that's not really where I'm going and kind of slowly veer back or even abruptly drop back. And you know, I use these devices and you have to read it. You have to read it fairly carefully. And it's not short. I couldn't even write an 800-word essay like the ones that syndicated columnists write now. To me, it takes 800 words to say hi. You know, I mean, I can't really do that. But if you start reading at the top to see what it's about and whether you agree with it in the first four paragraphs, you're not going to read me at all, or you're not going to understand me, and so I'm out of business. And that's not quite as true, I think. Well, poets, that's another problem, especially because you have to pay close attention. In any literature where it requires not only a certain amount of background but a lot of attention, is going to be in trouble. I think the last literate people to be completely obsolete probably will be the storytellers, you know, the novelists, because that's something that people can respond to, and they are used to narrative, not complicated narrative, but narrative. I mean, soap operas, professional wrestling, those are narratives, you know, and if you give them a big, chewy narrative, I think one of the strange things is that you can't get a person to read a 2,000-word essay, but you can get them to buy a 700-page novel. And I mean, yeah, that gives you some insight into the human consciousness and the way people absorb literature and words. But I think that people that use, you know, elaborate personal devices and so on are going to be the first ones to be obsolete.
Is there anything in your writing life that you feel some sort of regret about, or that you feel that you neglected, or some other things you wish you had done? And another question growing out of that. What direction do you feel you're heading towards?
Well, I think this isn't a broad brush thing. It's a more personal thing. But I went to a college that has produced, as it turns out, about 2/3 of all the top museum directors and curators in the United States. And it's sort of a mafia, the Williams Art Mafia. And it turns out that, you know, Lane Fathan, who's now 94 years old and still lecturing brilliantly around the country, and these two others who are also 90 and still alive, were three of the greatest art historians in the country. And I didn't even really know this. And a lot of my friends, you know, I was busy, you know, being a fraternity person and so on, and didn't pay as much attention as I should have. And I was wrapped up in my major, there were some really interesting English teachers there too. But I missed all this. And of course, the Clark Art Museum, one of the best collections of Impressionists in the United States, is right there, right down. It's one block from my fraternity, and I visited it twice, I think, during my entire undergraduate years. And I love art. I love painting. In a way that's almost surprised me as I get older. I mean, when I go to Washington and New York now, galleries and museums that's just about all I do. It used to be almost exclusively basketball and baseball games and so on. And I really wish that I had picked up more of the language to write about it. I mean, I have written about art in a personal, impressionistic, almost on the level of, you know, free verse, because that just responding to it. But the background that I passed up there at the place where it was most available to me, I regret a lot. And I have a couple of favorite painters that I promote I'm dying to write about. One of them is Charles Birchfield, one of the great Native American painters. I mean, I sometimes refer to him as the American Van Gogh. He was a relatively obscure painter who's now, you know, famous among the cognoscenti. I mean, his paintings are his mostly watercolors are extremely expensive now. But he's still not one of the big names, you know, partly because he, you know, I guess I identify with this too. He went against the grain he was popular back when he was doing bleak industrial landscapes and so on, back in the 30s when that was popular. He was a well-known painter then and had big galleries in New York and so on. But as painting became more abstract, he became totally contemptuous and made all these remarks about these fools who couldn't draw and refused to have anything to do with that art world. I mean, you know, like Hopper, who was his friend and who had the same agent, Hopper was smart enough to keep on playing the game with the museums and serving on juries and so on and shaking hands with the abstract expressionists. So his work remained really famous. And Birchfield went back to Western New York, to the woods where he'd always lived, and just did these wild kind of landscapes that are informed by it's expressionism almost, you know, because most of what you see on the canvas is coming out of Birchfield rather than back to him from the landscapes that he's looking at, and they're just nothing like them. I mean, some of the later ones that he did when he was in his 60s and so on are just the most mesmerizing thing that any American painter ever did. And he also did it, he wrote a journal for 50 years. He was one of the truly articulate plastic artists. And I'd love to do a book on Charles Birchfield. I mean, every once in a while when I meet somebody at a party in New York or something someone tells me that they're an art publisher, I'm always kind of keeping my powder dry. You know, this is something I'd really like to do. But the book that I'm writing now, and it's hard because I've been sticking with this under 2,000 word form for so many years. It's funny how you become your form in a certain way. I mean, if I don't get up to 1,500 words, I feel that I haven't expressed myself. If I get over 2,500, I feel that I've written War and Peace. You know, I mean, it's just this bell goes off in my head. I feel like I've been out on the road for hours. And it's really hard for me to expand that, but the book I'm writing is going to be called Babe in the Woods, and it's about innocence, which I think is a very important thing. It's a big essay on innocence in my book, Unarmed But Dangerous. The sense that childhood is valuable, you know, it's one of our best inventions, and the combination of commercial exploitation, sexual exploitation, the breakdown of the family and the home and so on is kind of turning children into commodities and status symbols and so on, and they no longer receive the respect that they deserve. And these are going to be long and extended essays on everything from child abusers to baseball and the Puritans and Nathaniel Hawthorne. I mean, there's just a lot of stuff in there. And a lot of personal stuff in there. And I've written, I don't know, 150 words or something, 150 pages. And I really hope to finish it this year, but it's the toughest thing that I've tried.